Dear listener, if you're a Ruby on Rails developer or an aspiring Rails developer, I want to tell you about a resource I've created that I guarantee can help you become a better Rails developer, probably. I want to give you this resource for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. But first, a little background. I've worked at a lot of jobs in the past where they had a certain class of problems. Their code was messy and hard to understand, which meant it took forever to make any changes. They couldn't refactor and clean up their code because it was just too risky to do so. There was no way to know you weren't breaking something. Deployments were also quite scary. We didn't have any automated tests, so each deployment had to be preceded with a round of manual testing, which wasn't always very thorough. Not to mention, manual testing meant that we couldn't deploy with any reasonable frequency, and therefore each deployment was huge, which made the problem even worse. And nobody wants to work at a place like that, so we had trouble attracting and retaining good people. It's no fun to work at a place from which all the smart people have fled. The problem at these places, or at least one of the main problems, was that they didn't have strong testing practices. I'm willing to bet, dear listener, that you've worked somewhere that has had those same kinds of problems. Maybe you even work someplace like that right now. And you want it to get better, but maybe you don't know how to write tests. And maybe the people you work with don't know how either, or maybe they do, but they don't have time to teach you. That's where I come in. I've created a guide called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. You can find it at railstestingguide.com. I've been teaching Rails testing for years, and so I've seen all the common Rails testing questions. Here are a few examples. Which test framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? How do I add tests to an existing Rails project? The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Listener, this is a special episode of the Code with Jason podcast. I've decided to take an indefinite hiatus from the podcast, and this episode is the final episode before the hiatus begins, and the guest is Nick Schwaderer. We actually broadcast this one live on Twitter Spaces. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm going to invite you to speak. That's a good shot. I'm going to turn my volume down. Hey, Colin Gelbertson. I'm not going to do this thing. People in Twitter Spaces do this thing where they read out everyone's name when they come in.
Oh.
But so you should be, I should have invited you to speak. Do you see something?
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Okay. Accept speaker invite. Allow mic access. Okay.
Yes. And I've turned you way down, so I don't hear you on my phone. Anybody listening, we've never done Twitter Space before, so we're just having fun. And we've got our phones off. We're actually recording the normal way live at the same time. So
yeah.
Can I set my phone just on my laptop and it'll be good?
I guess so. Our audio quality on the Twitter space won't be all that great, I guess. But that's acceptable, I suppose.
Because you aren't using your fancy schmancy microphone.
And if we have our phones like a foot away from us or something like that, it won't be as good as if we have them right up to our mouths. But that's fine.
You live in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You are, not like inner New York City person. I bet you have something within hand's reach that can solve this. Like I have, without getting out of my chair, a paint can.
I do have this Kleenex box.
And then I could set my paint can a little closer to me and then set my phone right there. And there we go. And people can't comment, right? Which is amazing. So like, if this sounded terrible, like there's
well, people can't even comment.
I think they can at us. Like I just had a look there.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah.
If anybody's listening to this, please communicate with us somehow. It'd be neat to interact.
Yeah. Like we aren't going to, we talked about like, we're probably not going to make this like a make people speakers or treat it like a normal thing.
It's not a call-in show.
Well, funnily enough, you said it's not a call-in show, but we just had a request from Colin. He's going to be the one person that I allow in for a second. Hey, we're Colin. Gonna have
it's a Colin call-in.
Oh, wait, is there going to be a delay here?
You'll sound great.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Colin.
That's all.
Awesome. Cheers. And if anybody else is listening, like if something happens, can you just add us or something? I have a few things we'll hit on today that should be fun. So thanks, Colin. Take care, man.
So as far as technology goes, you know, I'm 38 years old. And as I age, I'm getting like, I'm achieving something like boomer status where like I try to figure out how to use like one of these newfangled TVs. It takes me like 15 minutes to figure it out. Having a similar experience with this Twitter space thing.
Well, the good news is you can just like set it on your paint can and set it near. So nobody can see this. We're not doing a video stream, but Jason and I are on video. Not all podcasts do video. And he was holding his phone. He's like, I don't know what to do. but yeah, so I feel the same as you every year, even just in the Rails ecosystem. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't even have to be the whole world. There'll be all this stuff where like I'll pair with someone. I really hate to bring age into it, but I could be pairing with someone 10 years my junior, and they're just like showing me the cool stuff that I'm just sitting here doing CRUD, Rails, plain old Ruby, going on to teams that like are really just like honing in on that. And then I'm seeing what like VS Code can do if you're using React to like autocomplete or you know just whatever the tooling is out there. I can't keep up with it, and I think it's possible as a programmer to just seek out new stuff all the time, and I feel like I do that, but I just can't keep up. Like smart TVs, my TV I got used in 2016. It has a bunch of HDMI you know plugs in it, and that's pretty much what I need. But I've never used a TV that I like could control from the remote.
Well, you know, I sometimes come across the question of like, how do you keep up to date and stuff like that? And honestly, I feel like keeping up to date is maybe a little bit overvalued. Actually, I think this came up, maybe you were even in the room, Nick. This was like a RubyConf live podcast or something like that. And it's like, yeah, you have like a budget, you know, you have this entire budget of like all your waking hours. You have to spend a certain amount of time working, and maybe you want to allocate a certain amount of your time for learning, and you can spend some time learning about old stuff. Like you could learn about SQL and the relational model, stuff that's been around for many decades, and or you can learn about whatever's new. And for me personally, I prefer to learn even like I go even deeper into the old stuff before I learn a lot of the new stuff. Because, you know, if you just wait a bit, like a large proportion of that new stuff will just be gone. And so you will have, if you focus like only on the new stuff, you will have wasted a large proportion of your time because it won't be relevant because not all that stuff is going to stay. And then B, there's the opportunity cost of spending that time learning the new stuff and not learning the old stuff. So I actually don't value keeping up to date that much.
Yeah, I'd like to say like where I really agree with you on this, and I want to give two specific examples. One with Ruby archaeology, I read so much stuff from 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Generally don't go much newer than that, where everybody was like, oh my gosh, you have to learn this thing. And engineers today will have never heard of it. You know, like just like certain data stores that everyone thought was going to be the new hotness, certain deployment stuff that everyone thought was going to be the new hotness. Obviously, frameworks too. And everyone was just crushing, running over each other to learn these things and build context for this tooling that was definitely the new cool tooling. And it's gone. Like it had like 2 to 6 years. And then the apps that are on it now are like regretting being on it. Another one that I think anyone could participate in is listen to any political panel comedy show 6 weeks after it's aired. So a good example I could think is Bill Maher, because that's been around a long time. Listen to Bill Maher, because you can pull it up on a podcast, I think, 6 weeks after he's aired. And I'm not getting political here. I don't talk politics, but it's the best example for like, wow, all of this stuff isn't relevant or funny anymore because this was relevant 6 weeks ago. So it's even faster there. But I think tech is similar, just a little longer, right?
Yeah, it's funny. You can like kind of carbon date an app. It's like, oh, this app uses, what was that framework even called? Oh, yeah, Backbone. It's like this app uses Backbone and HAML and whatever else. I can kind of date this app within like 3 years based on the technologies it uses. Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember like when I was looking at code schools 8 years ago, I've just dated myself. Mm. But yeah, it was like, you know, Rails, and you're also going to learn Backbone. I've not heard the word Backbone. Like,
yeah, it just like completely went away.
But I think obviously it's not new to people that JavaScript has a little bit more of that than our community. But we could have, right? Like something I got to talk out now, and I focus a little bit on, you know, that MERB event in 2009 where it merged with Rails for Rails 3. And it's kind of like almost a community thing happened there where it's like, hey, why don't we put our heads together and make something that serves everyone and is really nice and use all of our cycles and energy together. And then ever since then, we've been pretty, I'm about different. Literally my current talk giving at RubyConf is about different old school frameworks. So like, yeah, I love that stuff. Anyway, by the way, I just wanted to get a little formal for a second, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say, we've been just yakking away for a minute, and for the people listening, this is the Code with Jason podcast, even though I don't host a podcast, but I'm acting hostess because I feel like this should be about Jason today, and I just want to take a moment to like kind of say thank you for everything you've done in the community over the years. I'd like to give a story about when I first like heard who Jason Sweat was. I've never told you this one, by the way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was doing a little research before this. And then after that, I'd like to kind of go through some of the stuff that I remember that you've done over the years. Because, you know, not everybody appreciates, like, your commitment to the community. And, like, it's very easy to not just see the work that goes by. But here we go. My first Jason Sweat encounter experience? Like, I didn't know you at the time, obviously. The year was 2016. I was in my first coding job. I was a couple of years in Cornwall. Now, this is particularly important. I was living in one part of Cornwall, and my job was in another part. So I couldn't drive in the UK, even though I'd been driving for like 12 years, because laws. So I would leave my house. I would walk 15 minutes to a bus. I would take a 25-minute bus. I would wait half an hour for a train. This is not even a lie. I can like prove this after the chat. I would take a 1 hour train, then I would wait, and then I would take a 15-20 minute bus, and then I would ride a ferry, and then I would walk to work. Luckily, it was a hybrid work setup. This was only 2 days a week, but it was still about 2.5 hours each way for me. So it was about 10 hours a week, so 5 hours each way. So I was like blazing through every podcast around that time. I could tell you what it was, you know. And in fact, I've been listening to the podcast since I first picked up Ruby in March 2014. And I heard Angular on Rails with Jason Sweat in October 2016. And that was one around the time when I was like, dang, I really need to learn this Angular thing. And it's 6 years later and I still haven't heard it. But that's the first time that I ever heard you on a podcast. And yeah, that was it. So it feels like yesterday, but it's so weird because I met you years after that. I don't really associate the two Jasons, but yeah, you're just around. And for our listeners, I'd like to just give a little few things. So things that I know Jason's done, you've definitely done a lot more, is you've spoke at RailsConf, you know, coding with an organized mind. You spoke at RubyConf, gentle intro to Docker workshop. You spoke at RubyHack, and you also, and I don't know which of these conferences were, spoke at India, the Netherlands, Bulgaria, and Nigeria. You are known for the hottest takes on Twitter, I think. You don't really say this about yourself. And you've also put on one of my, if not my favorite conference of all time, Sin City Ruby, and also the complete guide to Rails testing with Jason. And of course, something that you don't, nobody else knows, but I know, you tell really, really good histories or stories and histories about Michigan Mormon history. By the way, neither of us are Mormon, at least not so far as I know, but that was good. And obviously the thing we know you the most for is your soup podcasting.
Of course, the soup episodes. And that's one of the things on my list, by the way, that I hope we can get to today. but thank you for that. I'm very flattered. Yeah, and I appreciate you coming here and kind of helping with this. I'm hesitant to call it a send-off because, again, as you and I talked pre-show, I don't know how long this hiatus is going to be. It might not actually end up being very long. It's one of those things where, like, the universe is kind of making this decision for me, you know? And, like, there was, like, a long period of, like, kind of lower activity with the podcast. But then now that I'm, like, deciding to take a hiatus, like, all these opportunities for episodes are coming up. And I'm like, shit, I picked, like, the wrong time to do a hiatus, maybe. But anyway, I'm going to take a break for a bit because, like, I feel like I need a break. And then I'll come back. Who knows? Maybe it'll be a month. Maybe it'll be 6 months. It's probably not going to be like 2 years or something like that. It'll be a relatively short break.
Yeah, but still, like, it's one of those things. And by the way, how's your audio coming through for your ears and everything? You okay? There's no weird sounds.
It's good. There's...
If I take my headphones off, I hear a little bit. But if I put my headphones on, it's grand. It's fine.
Yeah, I usually do one ear on, one ear off, so I can hear my unadulterated voice. But I put both headphone thingies. What do you call this? What do you call one thing of a headphone? Do you call it a headphone?
One phone. Well, actually, I have a good one for you on a similar line to that. What do you call these on my glasses?
I don't know.
What do you call them? There's a whole thing here in the UK about it. Like, that's why I'm asking. There's people here who either call them the arms or the legs.
Oh, interesting. I've never heard...
I call them tines.
Oh, like the tines on a fork.
Because I'm a programmer, I'm really serious about stuff, right?
Well, it's an object to which I've never heard anyone refer until now.
Yeah, you got glasses on now, right? So you're not... They aren't foreign to you. But
no stranger to the game.
I know. But yeah, what do you call one headphone? A headphone. Headphones.
Yeah, I think you just called it, or maybe it's an earpiece. I don't know. Anyway, I have both of them on now because that way I can't hear the duplicated audio coming from my phone. What I really would like to know, though, which I don't know if I have an easy way to know, is how many people are in this Twitter space right now.
That's the classic thing. If you're listening to a Twitter space, there will always be a speaker who keeps going on saying, okay, We're up to 87,000 listeners. All right. Oh my, they'll be like, oh my gosh, Elon Musk just joined the space. Like, there'll be people doing that. But you know what? There actually are people listening right now. Just so you know, I don't know if you can see the icons. It doesn't really give you a number, but maybe about 16. So,
yeah. Well, it's a 4x4 square. So there we go.
That's it. Rapid math. So you just multiply by four along the way. And a few familiar faces in there, you know, from your lovely followers. Didn't really market this a bunch, right? I just literally did a tweet like, Jason has agreed to let me put you on my phone or have my phone going at the same time, right?
I sent an email out this morning to 2,400 people.
No, you didn't. Really?
I did. Yeah. And well, of those, looks like 16 minus you and me chose to join. So not the highest conversion rate in the world, but I'm okay with that. Dear listeners, you're the members of a very exclusive club hearing this podcast live right now. It's just you and 13 other people listening to us. And you know what? Even though maybe we said we're not going to, I'm going to do it. I'm going to just list off our listeners. You know, there's not that many of them. And I'm just going to say first names because I can't see everybody's last names. We got Colin, Joel, Chris, Justin. I apologize. Mvand. Eric, Hassan, James. Okay, dear Twitter developers and designers, a little request for you. Make it so you can see the person's, at least their entire first name. I mean, come on. But
yeah,
we got...
Wrap the text, yeah.
Yeah, something. Okay, we got Quico, Andy, Daniel, Manu. Ooh, this is a tough one. Diadwu. Never heard that one before. Oh, and VPiao. And we got, if you tap on the person's name, it gives you their full readable name. So I guess that counts for something. We got Krishna. And then we have a couple new joiners. We got Stella, Carl, Lucian. Okay, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, if BHH retweeted this or something, you'd be a little bit, or if Aaron retweeted it, you'd have a little bit of trouble keeping up. But yeah, so what you're saying, though, about the community and like you're saying about like balancing keeping up with things. And I don't know, like I'm a homeowner a year ago and there's other things that creep in, like literally. But I was late to this call because we are having our front wall replaced, right? Like, and I'm sorting that out. So these things all just like drag on your bandwidth. And also, I don't think people appreciate, I've done so much less with the community than you have. And even I realize it's a huge wedge of my brain. Like, you did all this and work and put on an entire never before seen conference in Las Vegas, right? Like, I'm sure it's a lot of dedication. So I don't think anyone would fault you from like allowing yourself a breather after like 6 years, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of stuff. Yeah. So I'm hoping to take a little break, get refreshed, get recharged, and then come back at it with more energy.
Yeah. So I think it'd be fun to kind of like, you know, just have a nice chat. We always like talking.
Yeah.
Just so folks like know, Jason's never invited me on his podcast with an agenda saying, can you talk about this amazing thing that you've built? Like, and a lot of people do, you know, but we just kind of have a conversation and see where it takes us. Sometimes it goes quite wild. I don't know if you remember our first time on the podcast, but we spent, I swear, half of an hour talking about the phrase, strong opinions loosely held.
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. Like, you know, so, but that's the beauty of not having a formal outline. You can just kind of like tap into any of those topics, or, you know, or you can go into soup, which I think is a really good topic.
Well, you know what go ahead.
No. What were you saying?
I was just going to say, one of the reasons I enjoy having this podcast is because it's an opportunity for me to talk about things that I want to talk about that aren't really like normal things to talk about that you don't get to talk about in day-to-day life. Like, you know, I had a whole episode. I don't know how many people actually listened to or enjoyed this episode, but I had a whole podcast episode about aliens. And that's not really relevant to anything. Yeah, there was this guy, he wrote a book called A Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy. He's a scientist, actually. I had him on the show, and we just talked about aliens for the entire episode. And, you know, it's tech adjacent, I suppose. But anyway, it's just an excuse for me to talk about whatever I want, which I enjoy, and I think sometimes other people enjoy it, too.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think that's something I'd be interested in seeing more of is, you know, some of these tech podcasts bringing on tech adjacent people because we might have similar interests, whether it be aliens or zoology or any of that stuff. Something that we talked about bringing up on Twitter since we last spoke was lockpicking. It's kind of in that soup space.
Sorry, so, Nick, before we get into that, I'm gonna crack my drink here. Should we briefly mention what we're sipping on here?
Yeah, so it's 5:30 p.m. here in the UK, and so I'm having a lovely grown-up beverage, a nice big beer. And Jason, it is probably 12:42 your time. And hold it up to the camera again. Jason is having a V8 low sodium original. So not only is it a vegetable juice drink in America, which is literally just blitzed vegetables, but it's low sodium. So they've removed even more of the fun from the drink, right?
Let me have a sip and see what my first impressions are. I haven't had one of these in a while.
It's basically soup. It's soup in a can.
It's basically soup in a can. You know, it's still pretty dang salty, but I like it. That's one of the, as you said, that's one of the appeals of V8 is it's a salty, tomatoey blast of cold soup.
I grew up in a household where my dad told a big V8 story. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever have, some people have a parent or a family member who just tells these stories, and then they, about every 12 to 18 months, they tell the whole story again with great enthusiasm, either to you or to someone near you. And then that's like one of the, like those things emblazoned in your mind. And my dad, literally, that's every time I think of V8, had this story about how he hated V8 juice and he hated tomato juice and he just despised them. And they had this like 45-minute thing about having appendicitis in like 1967. Couldn't find his parents, you know, because they were out camping for like consent to cut him open and remove his appendix. And he's so ill. But he said when he came out, don't know if this is the case anymore, all he could drink was tomato juice or V8. That's all he is allowed to drink. And so ever since then, he's been obsessed with V8 juice and kept trying to get me into it, and I can't. But maybe now I will, now that I've repictured it as soup. It's just a tin of soup.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, it's some of these foods, like, I have them when I'm a kid, and you, like, maybe you associate fond memories with certain foods, and then you don't have them for a long time, many years, and then you go back and try them again as an adult, and you're like, wait, I used to love this stuff, but it actually sucks. And that's kind of the experience I'm having right now with I used to really enjoy V8 when I was a kid, but now I'm not really that into it anymore. I think I've spoiled myself. So no offense to my parents, but when I was growing up, the food we ate was not very good. My parents were not good cooks. And so I've kind of gone hard the other direction, and I've gotten like really into cooking, and like I really value eating good food. So does my wife, and I suppose so do our kids. And so now, like, having this like what I think is pretty high quality home cooked food, going back to like, I don't know, pizza rolls. I used to love pizza rolls. Oh. I still like pizza rolls, but it's just not quite the same now going back.
Yeah, like, I think that could be a whole podcast episode. What things suck now that you're an adult that were awesome when you were a kid? Like, I could, we're not even a kid. Like, for me, there's some of this America, UK stuff too. So I used to be really nostalgic for Pendleton Canadian whiskey because I just affiliated it with a lot of good memories and friendships and poker and stuff back in Montana. And, you know, then I moved here and I'm in Ireland, Northern Ireland, and I can literally see Scotland. So we've got dime a dozen, all the nice scotches and Irish whiskeys everywhere. And that's what I get used to drinking. And I go home and I have a Pendleton. And I'm like, oh, no, this wasn't that nice. This is just fine. This wasn't like, I used to say that was my favorite whiskey. I would tell everyone, Pendleton, that's my favorite whiskey. Pendleton. So it was, it's almost made me sad. You know, like, I don't know if you had anything that you've like revisited years after thinking it was awesome. But it's quite disappointing when that happens.
Yeah, it's true. One thing that comes to mind is KFC. I was actually, I have that book, The Food Lab by Kenji Lopez Alt, but there's a letter in there somewhere. Anyway, I lost my whole train of thought because I got his name mixed up with Ibram X. Kendi, and then there's J. Kenji Lopez Alt. Is that his name?
Both. I don't know these authors. I'm sorry.
Anyway.
You're saying about KFC and like not like having a different perspective on KFC. Maybe better or worse. I don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah. No, it said in that cookbook that, you know, if you go, he went back and tried KFC and it just like didn't hit the spot the way it did when he was a kid. And I've gone back and I've tried KFC and it's like, yeah, this is actually kind of gross, to be frank. But when I was a kid, I loved it. I thought it was great.
See, and I've had the reverse experience. So I never really had KFC growing up, but the UK is mad for it. It's like up there with McDonald's for like on every, like for how common it is. So I've only had it really as an adult. And I'm like, yeah, the Zinger Burger is pretty good.
Zinger Burger?
Yeah. You know, like the filet with the boneless filet with the like hot sauce. I mean, to you, it'd be cold sauce, but you know. oh my God, wait, can I totally derail this coding related
yeah,
podcast?
Go ahead.
So here's the thing that I was trying to explain to my wife and my cousin, my wife's cousin, in a bar last night. We were talking about various things that didn't exist. And how do you explain to a foreigner? I'm assuming this exists in Michigan. It may not. I really hope that you've heard of it. The Schwann Man or the Schwann's truck.
Oh, yeah.
How do you explain that to a foreigner? Because there's no, I'm like, okay, imagine it's the 90s. And imagine it's like, you know, how Tesco's does home delivery. Iceland here is the store that only sells frozen stuff. And M&S is the store that has the really nice food. So combine all three of those things. So really nice food, only frozen stuff, and home delivery. And like, that's it. And like, you know, my family business, you'd pull up once a month. Every employee would have their orders ready. The next month's order, the crates had come in. Like half the food I had grown up, maybe not half, but like, just is a big day for our family. Okay. The Schwann's truck was a big deal.
Come to think of it, I don't have a super firm grasp on what that's all about. I've seen the Schwann's trucks.
Yes.
But I've never knowingly encountered a Schwann's product.
Okay. So I don't know how you get in because I've never gotten in. I only grew up in it. But there would be a catalog that was full of pictures. Everything had a picture, maybe 50 or 100 pages of everything that could be frozen. So it would be like, you know, deep fried, you know, like battered jumbo shrimp, filet mignon. It could be mostly pizza, right? Like is what people remember. They're overpriced, but it's pizza, ice cream, just frozen stuff that's like good. Like you're being, this was our version of the fanciest thing we could possibly do with Schwann's. And they come at a certain interval. I'm guessing it was once per month. And generally, once they knew to come to you, you'd get your order, you'd give them the crates back from the empty crates. And then you give them the order for the next month. I'm sure it's all digital now. I'm sure you can do it online. But this is the 90s that I'm thinking of. Like there's even offerings they only had specific times of the year, like in December, peppermint stick ice cream. I still remember that. But like, how do you take such a weird, unique one-off business that was a big part of your childhood and explain it to someone else? I guess I've just done it.
I suppose so. Yeah.
But Michigan has stuff too, because you have you have something that no one else like over here would know, like Amway. Is that what it's called?
There's Amway, but that's international.
Oh, sorry. Never mind. I take it.
Yeah. International pyramid scheme.
But I feel like Michigan is very strong, like compared to like, I've never seen it in the UK, right? But.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess at this point, like over 90% of Amway's business is international. There was this big blow up, like when the internet first, when people first started getting online, people got online and they like talked to each other about Amway. The people in Amway talked to each other about Amway. And it was kind of revealed that it's all a big scam. And so the whole thing kind of collapsed. But now, for whatever reason, they're able to do business internationally. And I think they've maybe like shifted their business model to be less of the pyramid scheme thing and more of like legitimate selling products or something like that. I don't know. All I know was that the foundation of the business was a multi-level marketing pyramid scheme type thing.
Yeah, it definitely was. But the problem is, since I didn't grow up in the Midwest, I get nervous about saying that because like you'll have that family member, like I'll know it. I'll say it to you privately, but like then they'll be like, no, it's a really good business. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's pyramid scheme. Because we have that phase of our lives where you start having people you haven't seen in a decade, like getting your
slide. Yeah, people get into some weird shit.
Yeah. Like, you know, for me, there's like a percentage that was meth. Like that definitely happened. There would have been a percentage to pyramid selling for sure. For pyramids. In the UK, they'd say pyramid selling. I think in America, you'd say pyramid scheme.
Well, the polite term now, you know, there's the, what they call
multi-level marketing?
No, not even. I don't know if you've heard this term, the euphemism treadmill, you know? So the euphemism treadmill went from multi-level marketing well, pyramid scheme probably was never like used by the people who actually did it. But anyway, now they call it network marketing.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Like, oh, I really don't want to say mean things. I have a brand. Jason, I have a brand and I never say mean things on podcasts or in public. Like that's my brand. I have things to say that aren't very nice, but I do that off air. But yes, I have opinions as well. And you can, if you read my mind, you can guess what they are.
Well, my brand is as a cynical asshole, so I'm not constrained in that way.
We're a great balance.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
For those things.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's important to be judicious about what to be mean about. So I try to be careful in that way. Not that I never make a mistake. Anyway, where were we? I have some notes. I know you have some notes too. Any particular place you wanted to go next with this?
Well, you know, there's just things that I like to talk about, like, you know, some of the things, some of the highlights from your community work that I talked about. You know, I also like talking about being an engineer in our place in the world. So for example, you're in Sand Lake, Michigan, which I think is so interesting. Like, I lived in the Midwest for a while. Now it is Wisconsin, but you know, it's not worlds away. And I think it's so interesting, and like something I thought of before this was like, you know, if you have a good RubyConf with like 10 to 20 speakers, 30 to 40 attendees, but it works out, what if you just put it somewhere no one's heard of? Like Sand Lake RubyConf 2023, you know what I'm saying? But obviously,
I've thought of that. And that's so interesting.
Infrastructure issue. But yeah, but like if you. Okay, let's say you did. Like, let's say there was the financial sides and the like speaker sign up and the guest sign up happened. You know, I think that's an interesting proposition because number one, you'd get people local to an area. So like if there's a conference in New England, all the New Englanders go, right? And Eastern Canadians go. And then if there's a Southwest one, well, everyone from California and Nevada is gonna go. So if there's a Midwest one that you'll probably get some Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, you know, hop in the car, you know what I mean? So you get that. But it'd be interesting. I think the Rails Camp West is still a thing. Is that right?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So I think that I'm not trying to draw you back in, but I'm just saying as someone who is, in my mind, organizing incredibly amazing conference, that I enjoyed so much. I think the beauty of Vegas, and you can tell me if I'm wrong because you did it, is it has like, it is pumping out conferences all day long of every size. So like the venues are ready. But if you're like, okay, well, I know a couple of caterers, you know, like, or maybe there's a hotel or maybe there's, you know, someone who has a farm and you can put up a marquee, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like in Poland, they used to do an outdoor one called Grill RB.
I came right? so close to going to that. Super quick story.
Yeah.
Back when I was like trying really hard to speak at some conferences because I never had spoken at one before, that was one I submitted to and I got accepted and I was going to go, but then I couldn't go. And so I emailed, and this was, you know, I gave them plenty of notice. It wasn't like a slip away at the last second kind of thing, but I emailed them. I'm like, hey, sorry, it looks like I actually can't make it. And they replied and they said, dear Jason, this is terrible. That was the whole email. So my apologies to the organizers of that conference. But yeah, after Sin City Ruby happened, you know, it went not due necessarily to any credit to me, but it went so well, like the feeling in the room was like so great, that even though I was thinking that that would probably be the one and only conference that I ever did, yeah. I decided after that maybe I want to do it again, but maybe not in the same place, because that was a bit of a challenge to organize a conference that was so far from where I live. So I was thinking maybe I'll do it again next year, and maybe this time I'll do it in Detroit, because Detroit is actually really cool and it's like unique and weird, and I think it's like something that would be really good to showcase to people. And obviously it's kind of a population center and you can draw people from Michigan, Ohio, Chicago, those places.
I tell you, it's a heck of a lot closer for Europeans, right? Because of the curvature of the earth. Yeah. Vegas is quite a 12-hour flight from London, whereas I think you could probably get to the Midwest for 8 hours. So that's the thing. Tell me about Detroit, because I think I have a bad vision of it from growing, like my childhood, my teen and young adulthood, that it was a rough place. Like I knew it had a very strong time, you know, with the history and Ford and motor vehicles. I think maybe there was a tough bit, but is it on the ups? Is Detroit on the ups these days?
It has been for like the last 10 years. It's been on the upswing. It's basically an entirely different place. So my understanding is, you know, Detroit became kind of a ghost town, and I think it's still actually losing population on balance each year. But it became like a ghost town. It became a ghost town, and like the economy like went to shit, and like everything, it was dangerous for a while, and I think it got like even more dangerous maybe. But I was told, I went on this like tour, and we were standing in a certain spot downtown, and the tour guide said, this area used to be so bad that the cops were afraid to come to this spot here. And now at that same spot, there's a waiting list. If you want to get an apartment there, you have to get on a waiting list for like a year because it's just such a desirable place to be now. So that has been like a total turnaround. So they've like really addressed the crime issues. But my understanding is that downtown has been like really addressed in that way. But then the outskirts of Detroit and like certain areas of the metro region are still like dangerous and bad. But, you know, that's like any metro region. It has its good parts or it has its like safer parts and more dangerous parts and stuff like that. Detroit's no different in that sense, but the downtown is much safer now.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of potential there with some of these cities, because the thing that is incredibly American, and I don't think any other country ever had this, is cities that went on the decline, but then like rough neighborhoods, this American 20th century thing with detached housing. So like you go even in the middle of a city and every house is like one house, single family house. Like it doesn't touch the other house. You've got a yard on all four sides of your house, even if it's tiny, right? So like some of these streets, if you showed it to somewhere in the UK, you're like, ah, that must be a $400,000 house. That's so cool. It's like detached. It's got two stories. But then you'd be like, oh, I wouldn't drive down that street. You know, so it's a very... Because these were built up, in the 50s, when things were going great. And then there were times when things didn't go great. And I imagine the population who was the most struggling couldn't leave, right? And things kind of cycled down. But I'm glad to hear that, right? Like, because I think some cities in the States have had a bit of a hard time over the last 4 to 10 years. So I'm glad to hear that there's some spots that are on the up again. Detroit a chance. So like,
yeah, it's really
in
great.
Town, downtown, right? In the airport, pretty good?
You know, I don't actually know because I'm just driving distance from Detroit.
Oh, okay. So would you fly from Grand Rapids?
No, it would be like, it would actually probably take more time to fly there than to drive there.
No, I mean, if you were going to fly anywhere, I mean, what airport do you use?
Oh, yeah, I usually just fly from the Grand Rapids airport. And then there's always a hop. Actually, now that I recall, I have been to the Detroit airport a couple times for connections, and it's good. It's fine. But usually it's like Chicago or Minneapolis is where my connection is. One other quick thing I want to say about Detroit is it's like there's such a culture there. It's like something somebody said about Detroit is like everybody wants to know what you're up to and how they can help, which is like really great. And that was totally my experience. Like, we went to this, I visited a friend there last summer, and we went to this record shop, and my friend is apparently friends with the record shop guy. We visited there in the middle of the day, and we were just, like, putzing around, looking at records and stuff. Came back that evening, and the record store owner is, they have this couch in there, and they're just sitting around. Somebody's, like, fucking around on a guitar or something like that. People just smoking cigarettes in the record shop, drinking PBRs. Just hanging out. And it felt like, I don't know, it feels like Detroit has community, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, because not everywhere has that by any means.
Because, yeah, PBR, yeah, okay, so that's a Wisconsin beer, so it's not far away. I remember PBR. There's something about that, like, as well, like a very, if you're drinking PBR with someone, you're probably close to them. Is that a weird thing to say? I think that's true.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, it's a really popular beer in Michigan. It's like, you know, the standard swag beer, that and maybe like Miller Lite or something like that. But PBR is huge.
Yeah, well, I think we've definitely marketed up Detroit for Sin City Ruby.
Yeah, come to the Detroit conference. Smoke some cigarettes on the couch and bring your laptop.
Honestly, so I quit smoking 3.5 years ago, but I'd give it a go. Maybe I won't inhale. Just sit there with it in my hand at a computer, you know, in a big pot of black coffee, have a little hackathon in between talks.
There you go.
Because Ruby Gems was built during a conference. Ruby Conf 04, right? The next Ruby Gems at Detroit Sin City Ruby Conf.
By the way, I feel like you'll be into this idea. I was thinking, you know, who knows if this like 2023 conference is going to happen or not. But I thought if I do something like this again, it'd be cool to have a dedicated cocktail menu. And I thought about a few might be, you know, you could have like the Matt's Martini or like, yes. I don't know. You can kind of imagine how that could go.
So I'm trying to think now. So Matt's Martini. There might be a DHH flavored one. You might look through the Ruby Cord
rails. DHH Daiquiri.
DHH Daiquiri. I mean, and then you could like, whatever you do with the ingredients, you can make it like a joke. So like, you could say with this, because like, obviously I can't make the jokes on the spot.
Here's one.
A Matt's Martini might be a virgin martini as well.
Oh, yeah, that I guess
I imagine he wouldn't have like I'm just guessing. I don't think he drinks, but that could be an interesting spin on it, right? Like, oh, just give me a Matt's. I'm driving.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, Matt, I'm not saying that you do or don't drink. I'm just trying to assume things.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, one idea I had was, you know, just to play on words, we could serve an old fashioned and call it the Legacy Code.
A Merb Old Fashioned? No. Because that's not legacy. That's just not really around anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. But it could be a fun thing to toy around with.
Yeah, I like that. Dedicated cocktail menu. And maybe it makes a return, like if this became an ongoing thing.
Yeah, bars across the country start offering it. So we haven't talked much about programming, which I'm fine with. And I guess I mentioned that.
What's that? We talked about community, though. Like, you know, we've talked about, you know, your work with the community and stuff like that. Yes, but we have definitely detoured a little bit about geography and stuff like that.
And the reason I say that is because I have a couple other topics I'd like to bring up, which also have nothing to do with programming, although they kind of do. All this is, again, tech adjacent. So I'm aware, Nick, that you have been learning Japanese. Is that right?
Yeah, a little. I have been for a bit. I'm on a current, for this podcast, hiatus, because I am going to Yoruko in 3 weeks. So I am actually finishing. I'm not finishing. I'm learning Finnish. Because Yoruko is in Finland. But yes. I have been plodding through Japanese. But I will say, like, with every European language, you have this huge advantage of knowing the alphabet. Like, even Finnish. Like, even if they pronounce every vowel differently, like, you know the freaking letters. But with Japanese, it's just like, here's three writing systems you've never heard of. So I'm like, wow, it's like literally a year behind. Whereas like with French, I bet in a week you could be reading it out loud from a piece of paper, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yes. I've been Duolingoing a bit of Japanese.
Yeah. And I don't know what it is. Well, I kind of do know what it is, but programmers love to learn Japanese.
Hmm.
It's like,
I can say for our community, like, I don't know about in general, but I can speak for our community about it. There's some Ruby documentation I've heard of, I think it's Kevin Newton that brought this up, that is much better in Japanese. There's some Slack communities that are very involved that are Ruby-JP, Japanese, and a lot of talks, right, and stuff like that, and interviews. And so it's kind of like, even if you never want to say it out loud with your own voice, if you just want to read and consume and listen, you'd sure get some wins if you could know a bit of Japanese. And then obviously, I think it's unnecessarily difficult if you really wanted to have a life with it. And you'd be banned, like, even if you learned Italian, something you could read right away, you'd always sound like a foreigner. And I imagine Japan is like 10x, right? I have two teammates who live in Japan. So I get to steal from them. But yes, like there are a lot of people. I mean, Aaron Patterson has given talks in Japanese.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, look it up. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be entertaining to see.
With jokes, dude.
Oh, wow.
Try doing a joke in another language. That is like the hardest thing. But yes, you prompted me and I went on a rant. Yes, a lot of programmers learn Japanese. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I have like loose suspicions as to why that is, but I don't quite understand. Japanese, also woodworking. Programmers are very attracted to work. Oh, and karate. It's like the standard hobbies of a programmer.
Karate or martial arts?
I suppose martial arts.
Yeah. I can I add one more to that list then, like about stereotypes? I have heard someone say, why are you Rubyists so obsessed with indoor air quality?
Ha!
Yeah, you laugh because you know it's true. I think the HH gave a talk on it. I have a CO2 monitor, very nice one, in my living room at all times. Like I'm very into CO2 monitoring for indoor air quality. I think there's a lot of people that are. Do you get into that? Like, do you monitor your indoor CO2?
No, I don't. It's just no. Well, and I like to buck trends and zig when others zag. So yeah. Just on principle, I probably am not going to do that because it's like, no, you guys do that. I'm not going to do that.
I know it is weird. It's like, you know how people with what they eat get into this whole idea of eating the most pure, like what our natural selves would want to consume. You know, like we can't have a processed popsicle. You know, it has to be literally ripped out of the ground, and it can't even be something that was bred like a carrot. It has to be, you know, an OG apple. Anyway, I think there's that part of your brain that kind of triggers with indoor air quality where I'm like, oh, I'm locked in a box all day. And that's not how the species evolved, right? Like not with, you know, we are used to like 200 to 500 parts per million CO2 instead of 3,000 to 4,000, which you can very easily get in your bedroom or your living room, right? So I think that part of my brain triggers like, I need the right air.
Yeah, for the last year.
By the way, there is good science on the air, but If you ever want to geek out on it, there's actually very good science on the CO2, not from like living or dying, but from like lethargy and focus. So like when I'm coding, I will leave the door cracked.
I definitely believe it. Like for the last year, I've been working in a basement with very poor ventilation. I'm working on having a new office built, which will be great. And it has windows, which will be a great improvement from no windows.
Yeah.
But I sense that there is a significant difference in like my cognitive abilities and stuff like that being in here versus when I was in a better ventilated place.
Well, how big is it? Like, so I have a little room that I code in here. Like, do you have the whole floor of a building of the house in your basement? Or are you in a room in a basement?
It's subdivided into rooms, but they're kind of open rooms.
I think that's pretty good. Cause like what I found is, if you had a room where you could just smoosh in four desks barely and you close the door and the windows, you'd get over 1,000 parts per million in a half hour.
Mm.
But if you had like, especially if you're talking, but if you're one person by yourself, like this tiny, tiny room, like what they call it, it's not tiny by UK standards. It would maybe take a half hour as well, maybe 45 minutes. But, you know, when I go to bed at night and you shut the door, like it could get over 3,000. I don't need my brain when I'm sleeping so much. Right? Mm-hmm. I haven't done the research on sleep. It's just on coding. But anyway, yes. So you said you had some notes. Sorry, I kind of derailed you with CO2.
No, as always, staying on topic is not a core value of this podcast. So that's totally okay. So I only have two items in my notes. One was Japanese/Chinese, because again, I didn't want to learn Japanese because I'm like, oh,
you guys Chinese, are learning, right?
Yeah. So that's been fun, similar experience. But I consciously decided at the very beginning, well, I kind of got this tip from this video I watched. I said I'm not going to try to learn to read or write at all until I get like somewhat fluent. Because that's what the guy said in this video. He's like, don't try to read or write until you're fluent. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So that's the approach I've taken, and that's worked out pretty well for me. I've learned that Japanese and Chinese actually use a greatly overlapping character system, because my understanding is that the Japanese writing system is kind of borrowed from Chinese, because Chinese, they developed writing like thousands of years ago. They were like one of the first civilizations to develop writing. And I understand Japan didn't have writing until relatively recently, and then they adopted it from the... As I'm saying this, I'm realizing that I don't know this for sure at all, and I could be totally wrong.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I think that kanji, which is one of the writing systems in Japanese that you can use, and I'm not speaking as an expert, has like 50,000 characters or something, which I think is borrowed similar from Chinese. But then there's the other systems where you can write out phonetically. Mm. So like, so maybe you know the character or the picture for the word, which you can intersperse randomly throughout a sentence, or you know how to make the sounds, like, you know, hachi or something, you know, whatever, like, and then you write out the sounds. So you can do it one of three ways at the same time.
Yeah, it sounds, again, difficult to learn.
I know. But so you got Japanese / Chinese, and why the heck not? Yep.
And then my other note was, of course, soup. So I was excited to talk with you, Nick, because between now and the last time we talked, I've eaten a lot of soup. My oldest son had his tonsils removed. And I don't know if you know about that, but I didn't know about this. But when you do that, there's like a brutal 2-week recovery period where you can't really eat any solid foods. So we're eating nothing but soup. Yeah. So maybe we can just go down this list. I just have 4 soups in this list. We can go down the list and you can tell me any thoughts you might have on each type of soup.
All right. You want to hear my thoughts on soup?
Well, yeah.
I mean, your descriptions are so... No, I will give you my thoughts on every soup. All 4 of them.
So the first soup that I made was broccoli cheese soup.
Heaven.
Yeah, it's great. I love cheese soup.
Sorry, I think you got to be careful with certain vegetable cheese-based soups. Like, you want to eat them with people you're close with, because not long after you have the soup, depending on the cheese levels and the vegetable choices, like, it can get a bit...
flatulent?
Intimate, yeah. Like, you'll really get to know that person. Like, French onion soup, man. Like, oh, geez.
Oh, I had some really good French onion soup the other night. That's one of my favorites. It's one of my wife's absolute favorites.
What is it again? Is it just onion in a jus?
So, it's like you take like 1 million onions.
Yeah.
And then you saute them for a super long time until they reduce into like a very dark brown whatever. And then I think customarily you add brandy and either water or beef stock. And then you put that in a ramekin and you put on top of it. They always use the word crouton, which is a bit of a funny word, just a piece of bread. But I guess it's a crouton because maybe it's a piece of bread that is baked with some oil or butter so it turns crispy. And that's what makes it a crouton. Anyway, you put the crouton on the soup and then you sprinkle that with, I believe, Gruyere cheese, however you say it.
That's what gets you.
Super good.
Yeah, like I've not had it in maybe 20 years. Am I old enough to say that?
You are deprived.
I'm all about like getting the new food though. And by the way, for the listeners, we have gone through 1 of 4 soups. We have more to come on the soup podcast. But on a side detour, so I work, like, the company I work at is global, and something I've always said to my wife is, you know, we make stuff. We make pasta. That's a time. We make kind of Mexican stuff, burritos and tacos. We make, you know, steak. But, you know, there's 100 and, well, the UN recognizes 149 countries. Every one of those nearly would have, like, some cuisine going on. Why don't you just pick the country and go from there? It's like, you know what, Uzbekistan, what do you got going on? I will make a couple of your big dishes. Let's go, unless it's really, really crazy. I realized I work at a company with teammates in countries. So like, not only would I be Googling dodgy recipes online, but I could actually say to these people, how'd your grandma make it? You know, what was your dad's secret, you know, thing that he put with it, and get that. And actually I've been, as of this week, stealing recipe ideas and looking forward to experimenting with that. So we can extend the soup podcast in future to a journey around various countries. I think you'd be into that kind of stuff, right? Like, you seem
big time. Yeah, something I would love to do is go to somebody's house in a different country and eat with their family something that they, you know, because there's a difference between home cooking and restaurant food. Like, there's stuff that Americans eat at home that you will never get at a restaurant. Like, when's the last time you went to a restaurant and had, like, I don't know, spaghetti? Like, you don't go to a restaurant and order spaghetti. That's not typical. Or like potato salad or something like that. Like, it's just, it's not typical. There's stuff you only eat at home. And so I feel like there's a lot that you wouldn't normally get exposure to. And so that's like a special thing that you have to go out of your way to access.
And you're lucky as Americans, because like, so many of the population have an immigrant history that you can have like varied experiences. I think, you know, maybe as the generations go on, it's not so much, because I think America doesn't have a lot of inbound immigration anymore. So like, two or three generations will have forgotten it all. But like, we had our recipes. Like, I don't know if you had it, but like, we had the family sauerkraut recipe, which, by the way, Ruby on Rails podcast here today with myself and Brittany. And there was an extended sauerkraut discussion in there.
So, oh, nice. I'm a big kraut guy.
This is my life's work, is just going into technical podcasts and talking about non-technical things. I didn't know you were a kraut guy. That's great. I've got five jars in the fridge, man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. End of the day.
So just five jars, like, quantity-wise, or are these different kinds of sauerkraut?
No, you know what? We are lucky. There's a lot of, like, Polish shops in the UK. We have a pretty good Polish population, and I'm at half ethnic German, so, like, the one thing that both populations enjoy is a bit of fermented cabbage. So that's where you get them. You don't go to the English shops or the British shops. So it's good to know that you're a kraut guy as well. Yeah. If you were introduced to it as an adult, you'd be repulsed. But if you grew up on it, it's just so nice.
It's just so great. Yeah. If I'm having a hot dog or a brat. Sauerkraut is a mandatory ingredient. Okay, anyway, we covered broccoli cheese soup and, incidentally, French onion soup. The next soup that I made was squash soup, and this was kind of a puree. And I thought that one was just an absolute delight. But how do you feel about squash soup?
Yeah, well, and actually, and by the way, like, we didn't really cover this. How are you for time? Just so I, like, engage this.
I got a little bit more.
Okay. Because I don't want to go on too much of a squash tirade if you're like, you know.
Let's hear it.
All right. I wonder if we have a different term for squash out here. Like butternut squash. You know, like, would you go to the store and say one squash, please? Or would you say I'm having a butternut? It might be butternut squash soup, right? The orange stuff.
Yeah, right? I think this particular one happened to be acorn squash.
Oh, okay. Well, listen, I love a good autumnal pureed squash-based soup. Did you put like a dollop of cream and like a little bit of spiced chili pepper over the top or something? Or how'd you serve it?
Yeah. So I'll just give you the quick process. So the base was, if I remember correctly, the base was just sauteed onion. And then I had roasted the acorn squash, then I scooped it out into the soup, added some amount of chicken stock, bit of cream, and I immersion blended the whole thing to get it to that. What do you call it when you like blend something up really fine?
And like the thin consistency, viscosity, maybe.
I feel like there's a word for it. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. So that's. Yeah. That's how I did that.
Blitzed. We'd say blitzed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so that's squash soup. And then I made a very similar potato soup. Basically,
was it blitzed, or was it one solid texture all the way through?
It was. Yep, and it was almost like, it was like mashed potatoes, but a little bit thinner, which maybe even sounds kind of gross, but it's actually really good.
I'd definitely try that, because all the potato soups I've ever had, and I love that you put this as a topic, by the way, all the potato soups I've ever had, it's chunks of potato. You mm-hmm. eat your soup and then you get like one piece of potato that's hotter than the center of the sun and you're like dying. Mm-hmm. But actually, yeah, I think that sounds nice. I'd like it if you could post your recipes so that I could try and emulate these.
Yeah, I'm working on a cookbook actually.
How was it received? Like, is this served to the whole family?
Yeah, so the broccoli cheese soup was a hit. The squash soup, my wife really liked it, and she's my harshest critic, big time. And so if she said that it was good, then it really was good. Potato soup was, but okay, the kids, I don't think they liked the squash soup that much. But the potato soup, I believe, was enjoyed by all. My oldest son is a big potato guy, so I think he enjoyed that. Oh, side comment, Nick, you were talking about the potato soup and stuff like that. I think an important soup principle, at least to me, is that the objects in the soup be uniform size to the extent possible.
This is great. Now we're not talking about soup as in like when we went to the Thai place and there was noodles and spice. You mean like a soup where it's either one solid liquid, like your drink you just had, right? Uh-huh. Like the, or it's either one solid viscosity all the way through, or if you're going to have bits, as they'd say in the UK, bits of something, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Can't have big and little. They got to be the same size for spooning them in, right?
And I suppose it's context dependent, but I think as a general principle, that's probably true. I forgot to mention a super crucial aspect of the squash soup was that I added croutons to it. And that was a big textural contrast that I think really brought something to the table, no pun intended. But I'm actually planning to make soup tonight. And this is going to be, sometimes things I make is just whatever we have around. I need to find a use for these things because we buy entire animals at a time. So we'll have like all these cuts of meat and we just have to find a use for them. And so I have this like bulk breakfast sausage. It was in the freezer and I got it out and I'm like, what am I going to do with this? So I think what I'm going to do, it's going to be a soup with, I'm thinking onions, celery, course, the sausage, and then potato. But with the potato, I'm not going to do big old chunks of potato because I feel like that would be inappropriate. I'm going to do very fine dice, maybe like 1 centimeter to a side. I think that's the right way to do that.
Oh, that sounds so good. And by the way, with your sausage, you are on the right territory to make a gumbo, which I think is a great autumnal or winter. And I only made one a year and a half ago, but absolutely lost my mind. It was so good. Now, purists would say you need andouille sausage or kielbasa. Listen, you got sausage, slice into medallions, and then you could throw some boneless chicken breasts in there and just go hog wild. But either way, sidetrack times two. I appreciate that you say you buy. This is why I like that you live in, what was it, Sandy Lake?
Sand Lake.
But this concept of buying entire animals was a thing I grew up with too. Or we would have bought like a quarter of a steer.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, we wouldn't buy the whole steer. We didn't have room in our freezers for a steer, but like, we could fit a quarter of a steer. Like, or you buy a lamb, or you buy, obviously, like, chickens were a thing that were auctioned too. And it's just like, yeah, like, you've got some meat and you got to figure out what you're going to do. You're cooking around your stock. But I want to give a shout out. We actually got a response from someone a lot more informed than at least myself, maybe yourself, about the soup.
Okay.
So Roman, who is a qualified chef who I've been to a fair few conferences with, he said, for your French onion, deglaze with sherry, not brandy. Next time you have a soup podcast, bring on the vice mayor of Flavortown. I'll gladly talk of soup.
Oh, shit. Okay. Well, I will take you up on that.
I mean, it's getting real. We're getting like chef level advice on these soup casts.
Slowly, Nick, this was just transition from being, 95% programming, 5% soup, and it'll just gradually, it'll flip, and it'll be 95% soup, 5% programming.
We'll just come on and be like, oh, you know what? Yeah, my job's going well. I'm able to finance my soup habit. No, but soup real comp. Question. This is so big for me. It's like out here, I've had to like kind of introduce like saltines aren't really a thing here.
Oh.
I remember every time you'd get a soup in a restaurant in America, you get a little packet of two sardines.
Yeah.
I'm on one beer, folks. Okay? two saltine crackers. And, you know, the thing was, you go, I think that's standard. But I feel like when you get to your soup level, do you think that that's heathen to, like, crush crackers over your soup?
Nick, I'm a soup enthusiast, not a soup elitist.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you enjoy it, but you're not a gatekeeper with your soups.
Yeah, no, I like a good salt. You know, if you have, for example, clam chowder, I think saltines in your clam chowder is like mandatory.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's definitely, I'm sure people have opinions on that, but I completely agree.
Because again,
it's nice. It's just, yeah. I don't know why. Maybe it's again a childhood thing. I just think it's nice. To have like two to 45 crackers.
Yeah.
you just mush up and you throw it in your soup and you love it.
What's the textural contrast? There's something appealing about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, dipping your bread. So you have a fourth soup for me.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really the fifth soup because you told me what you're making tonight. But
well, it's really the sixth soup because we also did French onion soup.
That's true.
We're going to be precise about it.
There were six soups,
Oh, I'm glad that I put this one last because it's the craziest of all the soups.
Here we go.
So this one was a black bean soup. Not that crazy so far, but you might know about this, Nick, but it's customary in certain cuisines to have black bean soup with a topping of bananas.
I've never heard of this.
And I saw that in the recipe, and I'm like, this is the most fucked up thing I've ever heard in my life. And then I tried it, and my younger son tried it too. And it was astonishingly great. You would never think so, but it was so great. And it wasn't a weird combo. Like, it felt very natural. Like, the sweetness of the bananas and the savory flavor of the soup, they like really complemented each other. It was great. I highly recommend it.
Honestly, like, I'm gonna need to get this recipe, and I think we need it on Twitter. It sounds wild, but bananas seem to do that. They seem to like go all over the place because I've heard of, obviously, banana and peanut butter doesn't even sound controversial anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of mashing up banana and avocado and eating it with a spoon.
What?
Yeah,
that's similar madness. Texture.
Same texture. One's green, one's yellow, right? Yeah. So it's definitely going well. So one more soup commenter question. Colin just like tweeted us. What about chili? Beans or no beans?
Oh, interesting question.
Soup adjacent.
I apologize. One second. While you were talking, Nick, I did bring up this black bean soup recipe. It was a Jack Pepin recipe. Huge Jack Pepin fan in general, but I'm going to click this link. Oh, yeah, here we go. Yeah, one second. This one, he seems to put hard-boiled eggs as a topping, which is interesting also. Oh, no, he's doing bananas. Okay, so now that I have this link, I'm going to put this in the show notes. If any of the, you know, for the overlap in the audience, if you're a Ruby enthusiast and a soup enthusiast, this is right up your alley. But you asked me chili, beans, or no beans. This is another area where I don't have like a strong opinion about this. I think there's no way that's better or worse than the other way. I've had chili with beans and without beans, and they're both good in their own ways. Chili is like a whole category in itself. You know, like there's no one canonical chili. There are many chilies. And so I think it can be good either way. What do you think?
I do have opinions on this. Mm-hmm. I think it is best exhibited by one example. So I don't know if you know, what's his first name? Brian Baumgartner. So he played Kevin on The Office.
Okay.
So if you don't know The Office, that's fine.
Yeah.
But he has a book that is called, he had a scene in The Office that was relatively famous for him having a big chili recipe, and then he spills it all over the floor. But anyway, based off of that meme, he has a cookbook called Seriously Good Chili Cookbook, and it says 177 of the best recipes in the world for chili. So I think the answer to that question is yes and no. Every chili I've ever made would have beans in it. In the UK, they always serve it in a tiny spoonful over rice. And I've never had chili with rice in America. And then when I was in the Midwest, they always put sour cream on it, which freaked me out. Did you see that? Like, people do a dollop of sour cream on your chili?
We always do that.
Yeah. Oh, see, this is, America's so new, but there's already these cultural fractures happening where, like, we would just have no side, just a bowl. It's just a chili, you know?
What about cornbread?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it depends on your family, like, how good they were about their sides, right? If you have sides, I think cornbread's like a standard. Or if you're just like, screw it, I want a one bowl wonder. Mm-hmm. Like, chili's good. For me, if I were to do it here, like just far away from home, rolling my own chili, for sure, I'd just get a handful of different beans that looked kind of different. I kind of similar to how I do my smoked beans, to be honest. And then I'd do my ground beef or whatever. And then, you know, like your paprika and smoked paprika or whatever. Maybe I'd throw it in the smoker for a while with my Dutch oven top open. Add some cayenne.
So I'm not asking this for judgment. I'm just curious. Are you using dried beans or canned beans for your chili?
I wish I was good at doing dried beans, like the overnight stuff and all that. But generally, I just get a few cans, right? Like just to, because the proportions are so straightforward. That's like one can each, you know, like a 1-to-1-to-1.
Yeah, I've never made chili with anything but canned beans.
I thought you were going to say dried beans. I grew them myself.
Yeah, I do. So I'm kind of a bean enthusiast, and I make certain bean stews. You know, I wasn't sure if we were going to get into the stew category, because that's a little bit different. But I do make some bean stews, some like white bean stews. I'll just say it real quick because it's simple. There's this one that's great. I love it because it's so economical and easy and yet really good. Like if you went to a fancy restaurant and got it, I'd be like, yeah, this is legitimate. It's just a pound of white beans and a chicken carcass and carrot, celery, and onion, just whole, not even cut up. You put it all into a pot and boil it for like 2.5 hours. Then you take out the chicken carcass and just pick the meat off of the bones. Put the meat back in, take out the whole carrots, onions, and celery, and chop those up into bite-sized pieces. And there's a few other things, but that's basically it. And it's like almost free, you know, because beans cost like hardly anything. It's just a chicken carcass that's like basically trash, and you got this delicious soup. It's amazing.
So when I do my roast chicken on a Sunday night, I can make this on a Monday night.
Yeah.
With the carcass. So like I'll like the breast will be off, the legs, the wigs, I was gonna say the arms there, and I could use the carcass and as the ingredient for this recipe on a Monday.
I've never done it with a cooked carcass. I've only done it with a raw carcass, so I imagine the flavor would be different and frankly probably not as good as if the carcass is already cooked. I've never tried it that way.
Oh wait, so a chicken that you would have cut up for a recipe before cooking it.
Exactly, because we use whole animals. You know, if it's a beef, we'll do like a quarter beef or whatever, but whole chickens. And so every time we cook anything with chicken, it's coming off of a whole bird, and so we just end up with all these carcasses.
So this leads me to my next question, because you know we're celebrating what you've done, but like looking to the future now. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're a lean pub person or a Gumroad person, or if you have a preferred publication platform of choice. I have friends who've done both or whatever the other ones are. What platform do you think you lean more towards now that you're taking a hiatus to publish your soup cookbook? Which one are you going to use for that?
That's a great question.
I would literally throw $30 at that right now. Like, no, think about that first, writing like a Ruby reference text. You could literally just be like, I bet you could get 4 of those recipes out in the next hour, right? Like, you're just like, I did this thing. Just like take a note and then just like mark down. And then I would definitely go through that cookbook and cook some soups.
You know, have you ever tried by chance to write down a recipe like in all its faithful detail?
I am such a, like, recipes that I write to myself are like web apps that I build for myself. I just know that I know my stuff. So I'll just be like, some cayenne, you know, like I wouldn't measure the microgram or anything. So like, and when I don't know about you, but I have a handful of web apps I've built for myself and like bot apps and stuff that I use most days. So when I build the UI for that, I'm only thinking about me. Like, this button doesn't have to have a cool color. I don't need all the tabs. I can go into the console. And so similarly, if I'm writing a recipe to myself, yeah, it's just like, normally with smoking, it's like insert probe, have this type of wood, go until internal temperature is this, change to this temperature until internal temperature is this. So it's like five lines, right?
Yeah, it's like for yourself, all you need is a list of vague prompts because you know the techniques, you know the rough proportions and stuff like that. But to write it out with the assumption that whoever is consuming the recipe doesn't necessarily know the techniques or the exact amounts or anything like that, it's actually extremely laborious, I've found, to my surprise, to write out an entire recipe. So I did one, that chicken and white bean stew that I just described. There's actually, now that I'm thinking about it, there's a lot more to it that I omitted. But that took a long time to write down that recipe. So I've come out of that with a new respect for cookbook authors because turns out it's a lot of work to write these recipes.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. Yeah. We don't want to overload it. But yeah, it's, you know what, man, being all serious for a moment, I definitely just want to say I'm grateful, like pivoting from the soup awesomeness. and hopefully you get to make a lot of soup this winter. But like, I'm definitely grateful for you being, I feel like a lot of what props up our community are these people who are like, hey, obviously I have some self-interest in like submitting for talks and like being a participant. But generally, as we've discovered, and maybe you feel the same, it can't ever be a wholly selfish act. Like, it is like, so because of yourself and people like you, we get to enjoy these talks, these podcasts, this content. And the majority of people who just hang out and write Ruby and write Rails benefit greatly from the fact that people like you do this. So I just want to say how grateful I am to you for doing this and for like having me go. Something I'd be interested in is this the end of Jason hot takes though? Because like, I don't know if you have a favorite hot take over the years, but I feel like there's been like such a good steady stream. You know how you said like you can be contrarian sometimes? Mm-hmm. You didn't use the word contrarian, you used a different word.
Cynical asshole. Yeah.
Zing, was that? So it's like, I'll say something, you're like, I don't know if I believe it. It's like, I'm not saying it's so bad that if I said something, you'd say the opposite thing. Mm-hmm. Like if I said test-driven development, you'd say screw that. If I said no test-driven development, you'd say yeah, test-driven development. But do you have any, by the way, I didn't prompt this, so if you don't, that's fine. Do you have any particular spicy hot takes that you either want to revisit or that you have that are a favorite of yours or anything?
Oh, that's a great question.
Like that, so, you'd like to echo in everyone's brains and just freaking emblazoned on their gray matter.
Yeah, there's two that are coming to mind that are kind of related, so I'll try to briefly describe each. So something I've been thinking about today, there's a question on Reddit that I saw, which was, if you had to build an app that you knew was going to have to be huge, it was like the next Airbnb or something like that, and it had all these requirements, what framework would you pick? Would it be Rails, Laravel, Django, Elixir, something else? What's the best choice? And I thought it was kind of, and people had all these opinions, like Elixir because blah, 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 whatever. But to me, it's like not an answerable question because the framework, in general, frameworks can help give you some leverage, but they can't structure your code for you. Like in the very beginning, you know, with Rails, you can like slot in things certain places. You can slot in some associations and you can hook up your controllers and stuff like that and build these CRUD interfaces very quickly. And it's wonderful and amazing. But like 5 years into it, Rails can't help you that much. You have to impose the structure yourself. And so something that I wish everybody would realize, and it took me forever to realize this myself, but Rails can't help you except very early on in the project, specifically with code structure, organization, understandability, all that kind of. Obviously, Rails still helps you a lot with, I don't know, sending emails and background jobs and all that like infrastructure type stuff, but it can't help you organize your code. So I'll say that. And then the other thing is the whole service objects thing, which I'm known to rant about. It's kind of like, I think what has happened is maybe people have not yet come to this realization that Rails can only help you in the beginning, and beyond that, it's up to you to structure your own code. I think maybe people are kind of aware of that in a bit of a subconscious way, and they say, hey, we have this problem where we have all these bloated models. We've done these skinny controllers, fat models for so long, and like the models are kind of the accumulation point. It's like a river delta where like all the sediment comes from everywhere else and it just gets plopped into these models and we have these huge models. People recognize that that's a problem and they're looking for a solution, and then they say, oh, there's this thing, service objects. Now we can have structure. Now we have a place to put this code. But it doesn't really give you structure if all you're doing is taking some procedural code from one place and putting it into another place. It's still your unstructured procedural code. What I'm a fan of is object-oriented programming, and that's a subjective thing, but I happen to think that that's a good way to structure code. Anyway, my message with all that would be service objects, as they are typically done, don't really add that much structure, in my opinion. And so don't look to that as a code organization solution, because it's really not.
I think those are really great hot takes. And it's something that I've been thinking about recently, because I think when you kick around this industry for a while, you kind of see it, right? Like, so I'll give you an example. I think today, if you were to write a Ruby gem right now, it's all you. It's all you, man. Like, where are you going to put that file? What's the directory going to be, generally speaking? Because you could, like, I've tried it out, you can do just a gem spec in a Ruby file. Like, it is doable to ship a Ruby gem. So even though bundle gem create can, like, give you a lot of ideas, it's up to you. And you see that really quickly because of the requires. You're doing the requires yourself unless you include Zeitwerk in there. So that's, like, holy cow, I have to make all these decisions. Whereas Rails has so many opinions that you sometimes forget that there comes a point where you have to make those opinions for yourself too.
Yeah.
Now, we were like kind of, you know, I'll say it, I don't know if I'm really to talk about, but like, you know, there's a Shopify idea about this like a year ago, and there was a bit of, it was leaked and drama. And then they hit the button on GCP to like shut everything down because I was talking about it. No. But like there was this idea about like, what if Rails had an opinion about the business logic side of things? Because we're so good about like the controllers and the views and stuff, but like all the business logic stuff is dumb. You can't just do like the interactor pattern or dump everything into slash services. Mm-hmm. But I think that the truth is, and if you take some time and do gem authorship for a while, you just discover, hey, OOP, figure it out for yourself, man. Like, remember that the things in app models as well can just be plain old Ruby objects. So you structure it as you need, and then you can scale as you need. I mean, I don't really work on the monolith at my work, but like we've had to discover that. How do you have thousands of people working on one Rails app and like actually do good business? It's something that we think about. But I think, yeah, if I were to like talk to myself from a few years ago, I'd definitely like to sit down and talk about your personal responsibility outside of convention with business logic in a Rails app with plain old Ruby, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, because it's like, it's tough, you know, because some people might hear me say like, don't do service objects, and they ask, what do I do instead? And the question is like, how do I do, for at least object-oriented programming, how do you do object-oriented programming? It's kind of like asking, like, how do you cook? It's like, well, yeah. I can't just like tell you that in one sentence. It's like years of training. So that's a bit of a tough one. I've had the urge many times over the years to try to do something to teach it, but it's such a hard thing to teach because you need examples, and those examples, it's like the benefits of OOP don't come into the picture until you have a certain size and complexity. And to contrive an example of sufficient size and complexity to be able to illustrate the benefits of OOP is a really tall order.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. So I think just working on OOP fundamentals, and then you have to make the decision when doing CRUD, REST, adding new, you know, controllers and routes, and traditional models backed by traditional database. When you start to reach the limitations that we can't just do that and then throw jobs at things, and you start to get a little bit more abstract. And I think you just have to, you know, serve it yourself. And I think that's the one thing that we are so married to is the idea of convention over configuration. You're like, hey, if you're at this point, you're successful. Your app is like doing some cool stuff. You're a grown up. You know, Rails will let you go do whatever you need to do. But the big thing is like, there's no right or wrong way. The thing I'd be asking myself is like, do I start to just go to new directories now instead of just app models? Like, even though I can do poros in app models, do I give myself directories that don't talk about Active Record? And like, I don't know. I think it's okay to have a lot of Ruby objects is basically the TLDR here.
Yeah, I think we need to come back. Just as, you know, soup is a broad topic that deserves its own episode and episodes, this thing of like, how do you keep a Rails app organized is such a huge thing. But, you know, people... In my experience, like just looking at the stats and stuff like that, I think people really love this topic of like, how do I keep a large Rails app organized? I suspect it's a big pain point. For me, historically, it's been a big pain point. It took me many years to like arrive at an answer I was happy with.
Yeah, and I think there is an answer. And I think the answer is in Ruby and Rails. It's not that you don't use it. It's just there comes a point where you do have to kind of strike it out on your own and figure it out.
I think that's like, kind of the key.
This is a whole series of podcasts. Because I'm very, very of a strong opinion, as we said in the previous podcast. I am of the strong opinion that there isn't a right answer. So like I would be reticent. I could say, hey, here's some recipes. Here's some recipes for ways to organize your code. But the number one thing, and I think that like I would say whatever is optimized for developer happiness, like the computer will figure it out. So what do you want to work with? What can you tolerate? What is like evident for user experience to your coders? And I think if you just optimize for that, yes, we finally got into code. Probably. It only took us like an hour and a half. But like,
right.
We do care about code and we do have opinions on code. So like we got there at some point.
Care about code almost as much as we care about soup. But yeah, I think you're right that there's no single right answer. That doesn't mean that anything goes and that every possible solution is equally good. But there's, I don't think it would be right to say that like one single way is the best way. Because I happen to be a big fan of OOP, but I'm not going to say that I think that's the best way for everybody. Some other people might want to structure their applications in a different way. And if that works for them, then it works for them. But if people are doing things in a way that isn't working out, which I don't know, I've never worked anywhere where they use service objects extensively. And for all I know, it works out fine, but I suspect it probably doesn't.
I have. It's just a bucket. It's just a bucket for plain old Ruby objects. And you put the word service at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, like you'd be better off using interactors with the interactor gem, because at least that gives you some like syntactic sugar as far as chaining them together or like context and everything. But like, I'm not saying this for everyone, but I've been at places where app services is a bucket and it's just full of plain old Ruby objects where you say something, something service. And then honestly, you probably wrap it in a job a third of the time. So you have something, something service job. It calls something something service. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem very fun after a while, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I think sometimes people conflate the idea of a class with the idea of an abstraction. because like it's really easy to throw something inside of class syntax and call it an object and think you're doing object-oriented programming. But a class is not the same thing as an abstraction. And if somebody's listening and they like are curious about this, I wrote a post which incidentally was well received when I posted it to the Ruby Reddit. It was called Abstraction in Rails was the title of the post. And it was kind of an introduction to the idea of abstraction and what it is. And I think that's maybe kind of a big key to how to give your code structure when you get beyond the point where Rails no longer can provide structure for you. The idea is to have abstractions, concepts that mean things. As you know, because if you have a bucket of procedural code, it doesn't necessarily have a meaning. But if you have objects with meaning, then that can lead to understanding, and understanding is the key to be able to maintain your code over the long run in a reasonably quick way.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something I find very interesting. I'm sure a lot of the listeners, they'll be hearing this. It's just something that you end up running into. Like if you're a professional in this space, it's something that you can't really avoid if you do well and you make apps that grow and have endless requests for features. But yeah, so I'll say, Jason, for the purposes of today's live cast on Twitter Spaces for the first time in my entire life, and for your podcast that I'm acting like a host of, because out of respect for you, that's all I have for my notes. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover for today?
I don't think there's anything else other than to say thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the kind words. I appreciate everything. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, Jason, thank you for everything you've done for the community, and all the best. I hope it's a well-enjoyed hiatus and that you just get what you need. Because you know what? You know, you might find some people are like, between work and life, it's so much, but you might see like, you get that extra bit of bandwidth that you can either throw at lock picking or soup making or
whatever. We never got around to lock picking. Yeah, the hiatus we got to come back. We got to have some more episodes, lock picking, code, soup, all of it.
Well, listen, maybe I'll just have a Nick Twitter space and then you just pop up out of nowhere.
There we go.
But,
yeah.
Folks, thank you. I'll just for the Twitter space here, I'll say thank you for tuning in live. There's still about 10 of us on here, including ourselves. And thank you for the live tweets. I'm not really a pro at this, so I didn't really know what I was doing. And then there's tweets coming in. So I'm grateful that people like sat and held their phones near their head and pressed a button or like left their phone on the counter and listened to our words live. Like it's lunchtime.
Side note, Nick. Next time we do this, if we do it again, we should start at like early in the morning and do it until literally every single person leaves.
Oh my God. It's like a marathon. Like I will not leave. So someone's just going to leave their phone out in the counter overnight. Oh no. That would be rough. But yeah, seriously, thank you folks. And with that, I'm going to end the live space. But I think it went well. So if you thought so, you can tweet and all that. I think I'll be recorded as well. So future people, maybe even one person will listen to this. So thanks for the banter, folks. Cheers.
Bye, guys. Thanks.